This is Ozarks at Large. These are the first 15 words of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Since the ratification of those words in the 18th century, they've been studied, debated, and examined. Jack Rakove has spent much time considering the words. He's working on a book about them and how they came to be. He is the William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science and Law at Stanford University. He's the author of six books, including Original Meanings, Politics, and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. That won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize in History. He's on the University of Arkansas campus to deliver the spring Hartman Hotz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts, and he's with me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Welcome.
Really happy to be here.
The title of the lecture is Beyond Belief, the Radical Significance of the Free Exercise of Religion. Radical is a strong word.
It is a strong word. I don't mean it in the kind of conventional political sense, but I do mean it to suggest that there was something truly fundamental about recognizing broadly, not just the right to believe, but the right to exercise religion freely.
For governments in the Western world up to the 17th century, that was not something that had been
Not entirely. I mean, by the late 18th century, by the time when the First Amendment was written, there's a fairly broad recognition, particularly within the Anglo-American world, of the right to freedom of conscience, you know, the idea of toleration, meaning that most groups would be accepted as peaceable members of society as long as they weren't too public or too obnoxious. But there's a big difference, at least there's a significant difference between toleration, which implies that the state is giving a privilege that it can revoke, and the recognition that the free exercise of religion is a constitutional or a fundamental or a natural right. It doesn't depend upon a government grant. It's something we inherently possess. So, yeah, there is a significant development from, let's say, when John Locke wrote his letter concerning toleration at the end of the 17th century to the point where the First Amendment gets ratified in 1791, almost exactly a century later.
In 1791, this was referring to federal law.
Yes.
States could still have an official religion?
Right, and several states did. And in fact, we have a rather complicated topography or map of what the state of established or quasi-disestablished religion would look like in the original states. So, you know, New England, Connecticut, and Massachusetts retained established churches into the early 19th century. Elsewhere, you'd find a number of states practicing what we now sometimes call non-preferential forms of establishment, meaning a kind of general support for religion, at least for Protestant Christianity, without discriminating in any particular way between different denominations or different sects. I think you'd also find, though, that there's a strong movement at the state level away from even non-preferential disestablishment, a kind of growing confidence that congregations, denominations really should be self-sustaining, voluntary organizations, that they don't really need the support of the state. And in fact, that's essentially what 19th century America produced, a society of freely thriving, practicing, and competing religious denominations.
Almost any American who engages in public discourse or even private discourse about freedom of religion will at the very least be able to paraphrase these 15 words. It seems like something that is, if not completely agreed upon what it means, taken for granted. There was a lot of work, though, before this was written to come to these words.
I think a lot of work. Work is a strong term, but there are a lot of developments that take place. I think particularly in the decades, let's say the three to four decades preceding the American Revolution, preceding 1776, it's a really interesting argument that in multiple ways, not with any one theory, beating the drum for disestablishment, and not that everybody's waking up in the morning and reading Locke, much less Spinoza, on issues of religious disestablishment, but that Americans were moving towards a broadly tolerationist society where they did broadly assume that the rights of private judgment, the rights of you or I or every individual, male and female, to decide what he or she thought about the proper mode of salvation, that was being broadly accepted. there are people opposed to it, people accept it reluctantly, and a number of members of the clergy are not entirely happy to accept the implications that follow. The idea that, let's say you have a church in a community which is essentially functioning like a parish church, mm-hmm. one church for the whole community. Or maybe in some towns you have two or three. But the idea that people could just come in and freely set up shop. Before the Revolution, that still would have been a somewhat controversial position. But in the larger American towns, you know, places like Philadelphia, Boston, New York, there's no effective limitation on the establishment of churches. You know, in smaller towns, maybe it raises greater sensibilities. So I think you make a good argument that America is already moving beyond tolerationism, you know, beyond the idea that the state should grant the privilege, to a more open acceptance of the idea that this is essentially a right that ordinary people can choose to exercise as they want.
The idea is to give – I mean, it's a very private individual concept.
Yes.
That you, me, yeah, everyone has, yeah, our own choice to make.
And that's exactly what I want to stress by the radical part. So, I mean, the significance here is that I think of all the rights we possess, you know, think of the rights protected in, you know, the first eight articles of the Bill of Rights, or, you know, throw the 14th Amendment in as well. But, you know, that essentially what I want to argue is that of all the rights we possess, the one that actually places the greatest autonomy, places the greatest degree of autonomy on your right or my right to do what we want, independent of public supervision, is really the exercise of freedom of conscience, which I think in some ways precedes the exercise of free speech politically. I mean, there's a kind of complicated history between them. I think it becomes easier to argue about God than it does to argue about the king. Hmm. Although what you say about the king eventually follows what you can say about God in certain ways. Yeah, so the radical part is to say that this is the most individualistic, the most liberal. I don't mean that in the blue state, red state sense.
But
idea of individual rights. I think the most subjective, meaning the one that places the greatest emphasis on our private consciousness. If you think about most other rights, they don't create zones of exemption from the authority of the state. You can always be arrested. You can always be tried. Your property can always be searched. Your property can be, you know, taken for public use under eminent domain. What most other rights suggest is not that we have an absolute protection against the authority of the state, but that when the state acts towards us, it has to do so in conformity with some fixed standards which will respect fundamental values. But the state can still act. Mm-hmm. It just has to conform to those norms. Religion is different. You know, it says here's an area of behavior that all societies previously would have thought should be under public supervision because, after all, it's quite dangerous to allow people to wander around spouting their religious beliefs, you know, for lots of reasons that European history confirms. So the idea of a broad acceptance of freedom of conscience essentially says that the state is going to pull out of this area. Now, that still leaves open if you commit overt acts, right? I mean, if there's outward behavior. In fact, there are lots of forms of behavior which might become problematic. So you have to deal here with what I think was actually a fundamentally Protestant, you know, Christian Protestant notion of religiosity, one that really places the greatest emphasis on what you believe in your heart of hearts, you know, in your soul, in your convictions about whatever you want to argue about, you know, whether it's transubstantiation or salvation or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But still, it does recognize a broad zone of privacy in that sense.
Well, the phrase, no law.
No law, right.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
Case closed?
Depends.
It says no law.
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. Well, that was Justice Black's position, Hugo Black's position, you know, the famous Supreme Court justice from Alabama, who was a, you know, strong New Dealer and, you know, very much of a Southern progressive. No law means no law. That's pretty hard to maintain. So although, you know, it's not a bad formula. I mean, in principle, actually, I'd rather happen to like it. But inevitably, cases arise, you know, situations occur that you can't cover by a blanket constitutional formula. So legislatures in one way or another are impelled to act. And, that's when you get into a lot of legal slicing and dicing, you know, to see which side of the, you know, which side of the coin you come down on, legislative regulation or, you know, the exemptions, you know, accorded to private individuals. But, yeah, there is a broad reading that says no law means no law, so just get out of the business, lock, stock, and barrel.
I guess that is, though, a sort of naive approach to take.
Well, in some ways naive. On the other hand, I mean, I happen to think that, the two guys I personally like most, being Jefferson and Madison, would be pretty close to that position. I mean, they certainly felt that no law means there should be no public funding going to actively support religion. But, you know, take a modern case. Let's say you have some altruistic activity something meant to be part of our general network of social welfare, and churches want to join in that activity. Should they be excluded because they're churches? Well, arguably not. You worry about whether or not there's something fungible about the funds and whether or not that kind of support will go towards, making it easier for them to propagate their religious beliefs. Maybe that raises an Establishment Clause issue. That's the kind of things that, lawyers argue about and judges ultimately have to decide.
You don't have to go any further than a cable news network or perhaps a letters to the editor page to find interpretations of what the Founding Fathers meant for this country to be when it comes to religion.
Right.
Does anybody get it right? Does anybody know? I mean,
well, if you ask a question like that, it really has to do with how we read history. When historians read history, and I think particularly today, we understand that there's a multiplicity of voices out there. They had debates just the way we did, and religion was one thing they debated pretty actively, and especially started debating more actively in the 1790s. In reaction to the French Revolution, and then on into the 19th century in the aftermath of the Great Awakening. So I think the first thing that what I call civilians, meaning lay readers, mm-hmm. are likely, if not to get wrong, to get in a kind of partial, biased way, is that I think Americans want to homogenize their image of the framers. It's like they were one generation at one moment with one mind. It wasn't like that. They had, sharp and, sometimes bitter arguments, and there's a range of positions. I mean, I like Madison and Jefferson. They're the leading edge of American thinking. If they're the leading edge, they're not the most representative figures. So that's one problem. I think a second problem you get is I think there's a lot of cherry picking that goes on, meaning that, it's just as lawyers say, get me a cite, give me a historical quotation that will support my position. I think a lot of what passes for, a kind of scholarship, I think particularly on the right, is a form of cherry picking, where everything would suggest that, a deep religiosity. If you look at what's written about Washington or, I think Washington in particular, also Jefferson, Madison was extremely private about his religious convictions. I've studied Madison for 40 years. I wouldn't want to say – I really couldn't say what the state of his religious thinking was by that time. So I think there are two big problems, the desire to homogenize, which loses the actual diversity on the one hand, and then the cherry-picking problem, which is – you're in this for political arguments, so you look, get me that site. Look for the quotations that are most conducive to my position.
And we as individuals tend to want verification rather than education at times.
Right. To be a historian, being a historian is a lot of fun because you get to play around with the diversity of the sources. But people want to make history work for them, have other objectives.
Jack Rakove is the William Robertson Coe Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science and Law at Stanford University. He's the author of 6 books, including Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution, which won the 1997 Pulitzer Prize in History. Last week, he delivered the spring Hartman-Hotz Lecture in Law and Liberal Arts on the University of Arkansas campus.